You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. What is Killing Western Civilization? With Douglas Murray, Claire Fox, and Yaron Brook.
Seriousness, I was thinking about this issue. I think any of us who are involved in considering contemporary society at the moment is concerned about the fate of Western civilization. But there is always a danger that when you say, you know, is Western civilization dead or dying or being killed, that you sound like some kind of conspiracy theorist lunatic or kind of paranoid or kind of a real a scaremonger. But I think we all know that something's going on. You know, something is happening that is making this kind of a conversation very important and relevant. Douglas has most explicitly written about it, some of its themes in his book, but I think anyone who is looking at contemporary society and its trends will know how important tonight's event is. I know that this is being live streamed, and I'm sure that people will be watching with some attention at what we talk about. But what I would say was, and somebody just asked downstairs whether our two speakers agreed with each other on this. And what I would say is that, you know, it's not kind of like, what's your line on Western civilization and is it under threat? I mean, we need to be a bit different than that, I think. I think what we need to do is to recognize that there's challenges to the concept of Western civilization, sometimes to its very physical entity. But that if we all knew exactly how to resolve that or what the answers were, then we wouldn't have to be organising the debates. And so I think we should have a certain humility in the face of this. And as an audience, and certainly myself as a chair, we'll be listening to our two speakers and having an open and frank conversation about, A, what we think the issues are, and secondly, how we think we might resolve some of them. So, Yaron, could I ask you to give us a kind of 10-minute introduction, please?
Sure. Thanks, Claire. And thank you, Claire, and thank you, Douglas, for doing this. It's a real pleasure for me to be here with you. So I thought I'd start by maybe outlining what I think Western civilization is, because we all throw around this term, and I think particularly today, I think it's important for us to conceptualize exactly what we mean when we talk about Western civilization, because I don't think Western civilization is Western in the sense of a particular geography. I don't even think Western civilization is a particular ethnic group or a particular race. And it's weird that I even have to say this, but these days I think it's important to say these things. Western civilization is a set of ideas. It's a set of ideas that have shaped primarily Western Europe and later on maybe the United States and more recently, I think, other parts of the world. But it is a set of ideas that I think is rooted primarily in Greek philosophy, in Greece, of all places. I think it's a set of ideas that started there, was lost to the West, if you will, for centuries, was rediscovered in the Catholic Church, was spread again through Europe, and we have been benefiting from those ideas for the last 500-600 years. What is the fundamental idea at the root of Western civilization? My view is it's the respect, the recognition of reason as our means of knowledge. It's the idea that reason is the way we know about the world. This is a fundamentally Aristotelian idea, Aristotelian concept, the idea that we can observe reality as it is, we can understand it, we can learn from it, and then we can shape it as a consequence. We can integrate the data into new data, into abstractions, and we can actually shape the world around us. And as a derivative from this idea of the efficacy of reason that every individual has, this is not something that only the philosopher kings have, that every individual has. As a consequence of that, of the efficacy of this tool that we have, that every human being has, that it's indeed what makes us human, is the idea that what is valuable, what is crucial, both morally and politically, is the individual, and not the group, the tribe, the state, the nation, the fill in the blank for the particular collective. And if you think about these ideas are obviously very present in Aristotle, but they really mature in the West during the period between the Renaissance and certainly during the Enlightenment. And to me, when I talk about Western civilization, I'm really talking about the Enlightenment, the values that the Enlightenment taught us. And in that sense, I would consider the enemies of Western civilization to include things, ideas, that came out of the West. For example, I think that communism is an enemy of Western civilization. I think fascism is an enemy of Western civilization. And I actually believe, and this is where it might get more controversial, that religion is an enemy of Western civilization. That Christianity ultimately is not a friend of Western civilization, but at its core, its enemy. That what the Enlightenment did was secularized religion with the ideas of Aristotle, with the ideas of a reality-based philosophy, a reality-based approach to life, and centered us politically on the idea of the autonomy of the individual, generating what we today call liberal constitutional democracies, or however you want to phrase it. But so that is to me the core of Western civilization. In that sense, I would say that Western civilization has been under attack, and indeed in dying a little bit for the last 200 years to some extent, right? Since the real attacks on the Enlightenment were originated by primarily German philosophers during the 19th century, starting with Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, Marx, of course, and schools that emanate from them all the way today to the postmodernists. And there's a direct link right there between those German philosophers and postmodernism today. So it is that whole school of thought that has generated the Marxism, the fascism, the many derivatives that are the enemies of the Enlightenment values that make us civilized. And I think today we are further down the road of an erosion in those values. And I think it's in part of the manifestation of that, and I'll just link it up to Douglass's book, which I've been reading. So it's led us to a day today where, and part of, I think, the stress we feel today is, one, we don't know what Western civilization is. Most people just don't know. They don't know about the Enlightenment. They don't know the Enlightenment values. They don't understand them. They don't care about them. Certainly in America, nobody knows. Your educational system here is moderately better than the American educational system. But they have no idea. They were founding fathers. They wrote these documents. These documents are somehow sacred because they say so. And we, whether you're right or left, they don't really understand those documents and the intellectual sources of those ideas. They just respect the documents. And we live in this amazing, materially wonderful place. We don't know where that came from. We don't know how fast, how abnormal the era we live in today, right? The wealth we have today is unbelievably abnormal. For all of human history, we've been dirt poor, under $2 a day for all of human history until about 200 years ago. They don't know where that came from. Where did that wealth come from? It's just here, right? So they don't know the source of it. They don't know, again, the ideological source that made it possible for us to be free. We talk about free speech. What are the roots of that? Why is that important? Where does it come from? That's being under attack. So we don't know what these ideas are, and therefore they are easily susceptible for attack. We don't defend them. And as a consequence, even when they are threatened physically, as I think they are from certain elements within the Islamic world, we don't know what to do about it. We flounder. We are afraid to name the enemy. We can't address them. We can't fight a proper battle. We're not engaged in an intellectual battle, but we're not even engaged in a military fight against our real enemies. We're weak because we don't understand who we are and what the ideas represent. Let me just end on this, right? There's never been a greater civilization than Western civilization. There have never been better ideas than the ideas that have been generated in the Enlightenment, post-Enlightenment. Humanity has never been richer, never had greater opportunities. And for me, at least, part of what represents this great culture is, the artwork that was generated by Western civilization. Everything that this culture has generated is under attack, but the attack is primarily from within. It's not from without. So the title here is Who's Killing Western Civilization? The answer is we are. And primarily our intellectuals, primarily our professors, primarily our thinkers, because they have detached themselves from the, or they've rejected the real ideas at the heart and at the core of what Western civilization really is. Thank you.
Okay, a great provocative start there, and lots of things that we can discuss in greater detail afterwards. I think it is unfashionable but very important to say we are the enemies of Western civilization. Not everybody gets that. It's always somebody else. But so that's very important.
Well, particularly in the Trump era.
I would also like to say that as a Kantian, somebody who respects Kant, and also the... was formerly the publisher of Living Marxism. Obviously, there's not everything that we agree with each other on, but there we go. Okay, so we're now going to hear from the author of The Strange Death of Europe. I think the thing that's really fascinating, actually, Douglas, about your book is that a book that's called The Strange Death of Europe that maybe only a few years ago kind of could have been cast out as some sort of strange aberration and read by a kind of small group of people has become a bestseller. And I've walked into airports all around, in all sorts of places, and there's your book and people talking about it. And I think that that's fascinating that people recognise something in that and want to understand it. So I'm looking forward to hearing you speak.
Well, thank you, Claire, and thank you to Yaron. And first of all, I should say thank you to all of you for coming out. There are a lot of things you can do in London on a Friday night. And at any rate, I think it's an enormous tribute to you, the fact that you want to come and discuss these subjects. And that, to my mind, is a sign that we shouldn't be too pessimistic. The fact that people want to engage in these discussions, that they want to think about these things, is, as Claire just said, an enormously important and, I think, inspiring thing. There are some people who say, well, people are always diagnosing the death of the West, always diagnosing the end of Europe. I was doing an interview recently for the BBC about the anniversary of Oswald Spengler and his great masterpiece. And this was one of the questions that was put to me. Well, Oswald Spengler said some of this 100 years ago. You know. To which I suppose there are two main answers. There are many answers you could give, but one of them is, it's not obvious civilizations die within an electoral cycle. And I suppose the second is, even if you're wrong on this one, it seems that it may be, I say this in somewhere near the start of my book, it may be the case that even peremptory fears of our mortality may be one of the things that keeps us going, which isn't such a bad idea to hold, actually. To be constant, even if I'm wrong, even if Spengler was wrong, even if many other people who've written about similar subjects are wrong, it may not be a bad thing to keep limber about this, to be aware of it in a way that is both realistic and avoiding something like hubris. I say that there are two broad things that I believe are the answer to the broad question we're addressing here tonight. And they broadly fall into two categories. The first that I think is widely recognized now is the fact that the West is something that has changed very significantly, and that Western civilization is something that has changed very significantly. And that the main reason for that, without beating around the bush, is that the West consists of different people than it used to until really quite recently. And there are many good things about that, and there are some negatives about that. There are some serious challenges about that. We tend to be very good at talking up the positives, very bad at thinking about the negatives, because, after all, what will we do about negatives in this area? What can we possibly do? The second part is the us bit, as it were, that Yaron also touched on. The us bit is, to my mind, at least as important. It's a chicken and egg debate about which of these things came first or which caused the other. But the second, broadly speaking, to my mind, is not just a loss of confidence in ourselves, but what I describe as the sense that the story may have run out. there's a wonderful French philosopher, very little cited, I think, in English, sadly, called Chantal Delsol, who wrote a book I always citing called Icarus Fallen. That book that came out in the 90s in France gives what I still think of as being an unequaled description of the state of modern mankind, of certain modern European mankind, broadly speaking, after the fall of the wall. And she says that we find ourselves in the position that Icarus would have been in if he'd survived the fall. We dreamt these dreams in Europe in particular. We dreamt dreams of religion. We dreamt dreams of states, of nations. We dreamt two dreams in the 20th century that were the worst nightmares anyone had ever dreamt, fascism and communism. And when the second of those dreams that turned into nightmares collapsed, we found ourselves in this situation, bruised, singed, beaten, and yet still here. So what do we do? Now, there hasn't been much questioning about this. Broadly speaking, the only answer to that question, when it is raised, and it tends to be raised in the spirit of frivolity, is why don't we have a nice time and have fun? We can buy lots of things we don't much need and replace them shortly afterwards. We can do jobs we don't much like in order to get those things we don't much need. We can entertain ourselves, we can watch television, and then we die. What's unattractive about that? So this situation we find ourselves in is a void, and it's a void I think that will be filled. And I, at any rate, am very wary about what fills it, very worried about what fills it. I think it's almost anything can walk into a void that extreme. By the way, I just mentioned that, I don't think I've mentioned this before, but one thing I found in the 18 months or so since my book came out was that everybody among my critics, at any rate, and sadly there are some,
a few,
no very smart ones, but there are some. One of the things I've noticed is that my critics always focus on the first issue that I mentioned just now and that I mentioned in my book. They all focus on the immigration stuff. They want what I say not to be true. They try to explain why they think it's not, and so on. And this, at any rate, for me, is a great disappointment. The main reason for the disappointment is that I was really hoping that people were going to challenge me on the second of those two things as I lay them out in the book. And I don't think I've found anybody who has done so. Which worries me, because it suggests to me that I'm right, and that my worst fears are right. I was hoping very much that people were going to counter this, and I just haven't found it yet. Perhaps we will tonight. But this, at any rate, is much on my mind. Why don't we have that second bit, the us bit, that Yaron and Claire quite rightly mention? Why, when it happens, does it just evaporate? Why do we talk about us? Oh, yeah, sure, we'll do that, yeah. Why don't we? Why do we have this conversation so shallowly? Now, I just add a couple of things to that. Three things to that, if I may. Firstly, by the way, we are going to be in disagreement on Christianity. We are going to be. I don't say it because of any proselytizing desire. God knows. But I think you cannot take Christianity out of the West and have anything that's recognizably the West. Because, as I've often said, citing the radical atheist priest, theologian Don Cupid, even the dreams we dream are still Christian dreams. The thing I think we are in agreement on is the Enlightenment. And I, at any rate, think that one of the things that we are all discovering at the moment, much to our disappointment, is that it turns out that the Enlightenment, which we on this stage, and I think most people in this audience, put much reliance upon, we are in the midst of discovering that the Enlightenment did not go very deep and it didn't go very wide. We overestimated its reach and its ability to penetrate. Second thing of the last three things I wanted to say is this. if I was asked to sum up, as it were, the root of the thing that worries me most about the question we're discussing tonight, I suppose it would be this, to reduce it, that it seems at the moment in the West that we cannot be the source of our own regeneration, and that a meaningful life in the West appears not to be able to be lived purely with what we have. We need to go elsewhere for it. Now, by the way, this doesn't, to my mind, happen with other civilizations, other cultures in the world at the moment particularly. I think it would be deemed to be rather rude if you went to somebody in a great culture like India and said, you know, Indian culture is not really enough. You should look around a bit more. Now, we may well think that. A lot of people may think that. Who doesn't want to have the option of looking as widely as possible around the world for meaning? But the idea that the West can't do it on our own, or at least we don't have the facilities ourselves in our own traditions, in philosophy and religion and culture and much more, is, I think, one of the things at the very root, if not the root, of this problem. And I finish just by saying one other thing, picking up on something that you just said at the end of your remarks, which is this. You mentioned, I'm so pleased you did, because people don't very often, and they should all the time, mention the unbelievable oddity of what we are in now. And I just mention that because everywhere at the moment, you hear people saying things like, we've got to radically change things in order to have more of this because it's so unfair at the moment for X group. And nobody ever says to these demagogues, compared to what? Compared to what historically? What are you talking about? When are you talking about? For whom are you talking about? This doesn't mean that we live in nirvana. We're never going to. Doesn't mean we can't improve things. We can. But this idea that is forever floated and never countered, compared to what? Always something off there in the distance, usually involving trampling through millions of bodies to get to something that turned out to be hell anyway. Anyhow, that's probably enough for me for the time being. Thank you.
I'd like to recommend, if people haven't read it, actually, Icarus Fallen as a book, because it's a fantastic read and really helps enrich, I think, this conversation. And it's one of my favourite books. I think one of the things that is a theme is this idea of the West having been vacated or vacating itself. And you made the point about the void. There's a kind of a crisis of meaning. But at the same time as there's a crisis of meaning, and I just wanted to ask you, there does appear to be a search for meaning. And one of the things which I've been trying to mull over, if I'm going to be generous about the emergence of things like identity politics, or even campaigns like the decolonization campaign, and when I say if I'm going to be generous, I mean these are both trends which I spend most of my time arguing against for obvious reasons. But I also see a lot of young people looking for something, looking for meaning. And if Western identity has been vacated, then being attracted, I mean, you were sort of saying, Douglas, you know, it's scary what fills the void, but you can't expect people to stand there, young people, and not do anything. So they start to look around. So I just wanted to sort of ask you that, I mean, Yaron, just to start with. I mean, maybe people like us kind of stick the boot into some of these trends, but actually, is that our version of what you said, Douglas, which is instead of criticising ourselves, we end up blaming the expression of the problem, if you know what I mean. So I just wondered how you balance that. Anyway, Yaron, anything on that?
Yeah, I mean, people need meaning. As human beings, we need meaning. And before the Enlightenment, we were too poor and were too busy to have time to think about what our meaning of our lives is. We just did our job and we followed our religion and that was it. Over the last 200 years, we've had enough time to actually contemplate meaning. And it's crucial that an individual have a purpose in life and a meaning to what they're doing. The problem is that most of the answers that people find for meaning are bad, are wrong, right? But this is the history of the last 200 years, certainly of the 20th century. You know, we search for meaning in communism. It seems to be back again these days. And we saw the results of that. We search in meaning in our ethnic group or our race or whatever in fascism, and we saw the consequences of that. We're seeing it again now. Even those are being recycling. Identity politics is nothing but the kind of eugenics of the early 20th century, you know, made more intellectually permissible. These are all false paths. And, of course, religion, I wouldn't be surprised if religion makes a comeback in Europe because of that search for meaning. Unfortunately, I think all of those paths are the wrong paths to go. The core of finding meaning is in your own life, in who you are as an individual and what you stand for and the values and purpose that you assign to your life and what are the requirements for your individual happiness. What objectively in reality is going to make you a successful, prosperous, flourishing human being? And until we get to the point where we start looking at individuals qua individuals and stop trying to find these collectivistic, you know, solutions, I think we continue to search for false, to find false meanings, and continue to march towards disaster. You know, and people say, look, the West almost ended. Let's be real here, right? 70 years of communism almost killed the West. We ignore that. World War II almost destroyed the West. So it's not like it's been smooth sailing and now suddenly we're in crisis. No, we've been in crisis for over 100 years. Things get better because we resolve certain issues. We defeat communism, we defeat fascism, and things get a little better. And then we say, okay, but we defeated those, now what? And we're still searching for the deeper meaning of the Enlightenment, is my view. The Enlightenment was indeed, it lacked depth to a certain extent, and that's what we're still searching for.
It's a slightly crass way of putting it, but some years ago, I probably made a mistake, but I spoke on a panel, a Hizbut Tahrir panel, effectively, because they were being banned and I was speaking on free speech. And it was a row between me and the audience and the rest of the panelists, in effect, because I said, if you want me to defend you, you have to sign up to Enlightenment values. I didn't go down well. But the reason I mentioned this was because one of the law professors, who was also on the panel, a civil libertarian, said to me, she said, we have an access course for lawyers because we find that, you know, with young people today, especially if you're going to be socially inclusive, you know, they can't study and they can't concentrate. And, you know, all the things I hate about contemporary education. And and then I basically had a situation whereby two young men stood up and started quoting at great length the tenets of Sharia law, which they'd managed to study themselves and learn off by heart. And they were her students. I pointed out that maybe she needed to demand slightly more of them. I say that because it struck me as that it illustrated something to me, which is we had such low expectations. They were, by the way, just British Asian kids who turned to radical Islam. We had such low expectations that we were excusing them. They felt like they joined something which had higher expectations of them. I'm not trying to be an apologist or provocative, but is there anything in that? It felt like there was something there. Is that too complicated? Sorry.
It's not too complicated.
No, I don't mean complicated. I mean, is it too convoluted for more important points you want to make?
Well, can I just pick up on a couple of things before I get to that? Firstly, I mean, just to reiterate what Yaron just said, I mean, I was reading a beautiful interview the other week in the New Statesman with Clive James, and the interviewer was trying to get Clive to say something wittily rude about Donald Trump, and he kept trying to get him to do it. And eventually Clive just said, look, you know, when I was born, Hitler and Stalin were still doing their work, and as I was growing up, Chairman Mao was going about steadily reducing the Chinese population. So don't like try to get me too excited about this guy. You know, like please have some context about this. And I do think that's important. I think just to pick up a second thing that Yaron said, The issue of meaning is, it's got its back. It never goes away, but my gosh, it's back and not being addressed. There are basically two broad outlines to the way in which you can address the question of meaning. The first is to say that we are meaning-seeking creatures. The second, which is not the opposite, but can follow on, is, and there is meaning. Now, the first part of that, that we are meaning-seeking creatures, you can pretty much get agreement on. And there is meaning, okay, that's the beginning of a much longer, and you can never settle that discussion. You know, you're never going to win that in a panel or something. You're never going to do it by vote. But to say merely we are meaning-seeking beings, but there is no meaning, seems to me to be a very big recipe for trouble. Because, as I say, and as you found out in that situation with Hizb ut-Tahrir, anything can walk into it. I've known quite a lot of people who've gone through that group, some who came out, many who came out. But yes, I mean, this thing spoke to a deep sense of meaning at that time. There was a specific, by the way, as you know, I mean, there was a specific historical reason for that, broadly speaking, whipped up by, after the genocide of Muslims in the former Yugoslavia, the attempted wiping out of a Muslim population in Europe, many Muslims felt that not enough had been done. As I've often pointed out, not enough Muslims subsequently said, thank God for NATO. But, never mind. But yes, there's a specific set of grievances at the time which existed, which should have been better addressed, which weren't, and which then led to movements like that, which, by the way, has very successfully diminished, I think, as a movement, certainly in this country, fallen apart. But yes, I mean, this is one possibility that movements like that get some kind of moment. I just would add one other thing to that, if I may, which is the one place that people are encouraged to find meaning at the moment is in politics. And this seems to me to be a very bad idea. Because politics is extremely important. It's extremely important to be involved in some way, whether to be involved in a party or at least to vote and to have your say. It seems to me very important. And cynicism about all of the political processes itself, I think, a very damaging, dangerous thing. I have to deal with that stuff carefully. So politics is very, very important, but it is not the meaning of life, and it is always a disaster when it is turned into that. One of the reasons you see movements of political extremism is always because of people effectively leaning all of their desire for meaning in life onto the leg of the stool that is politics, fundamentally misunderstanding what the role of politics is. That it's the, broadly speaking, get the groundwork in place for people to then pursue the life they want to pursue and with the meaning they want to pursue, but not to make that thing itself the meaning. It's always, and we see it at the moment, the problem. And I, at any rate, think that encouragement of people, you know, what have you done today to fight for X cause? It's like, you shouldn't have done anything most of the time. You should have been a better son or daughter, a better parent, a better friend. You should have been better to people around you. Were you a good neighbour today? Would be a much better question to ask.
I'm going to ask a crass question very quickly, just before I go out to the audience, which is the question which you'll know, Douglas, you've had most criticism, as you pointed out, for your book in terms of immigration, which is a crass reading of your book, which everybody is trying to say. Not everybody. I mean, those people who don't like it.
Crass people have tried to say.
Remember when I mentioned humility at the start? Anyway.
It's not endless.
I think that, you know, how do we kind of, or how do you, or either of you, or is there any kind of tension there? Because there has been, regardless of whether it's argued for in your book or not, a tendency at a crass level, actually, by some people to say, the problem of Western civilization is immigration, or is the other, or is foreigners, or is people bringing their religion and swamping us. You'll at least be familiar with the the meme and the trope. But anyway, so just you can explain whether you're saying that or not. But Yaron, what's your kind of view on the way that conversation is going? Because you'll recognize.
Well, obviously, that's the way the conversation is going. I mean, I do say horrible things about Donald Trump frequently because I believe them, and I think it's important to condemn him. Because I think, while it's true, he's none of the people you mentioned, he's a unique phenomenon in American history, and it's sad for American history to be at the point where somebody as crass and as ugly as Donald Trump is president of the United States. So he has certainly made that argument. America is in decline. Why? Because of immigrants. America is in decline because of trade with China. America is in decline because of nothing America did, but because of all these things other people have done to it, which I think is absurd and quite sickening. So I view, as I said, I view Western civilization as a set of ideas. I welcome anybody who will adopt those ideas into what I consider Western civilization. I consider immigration as a net positive. Again, we'll get to Muslim immigration to Europe because I think that's a special case. I don't think it's typical of immigration. I think America is a land of immigrants. I think America is an example of how you assimilate immigrants from all kinds of cultures, from all kinds of environments into a Western civilization, into a civilized culture, into a real culture. Now, whether America has a real culture or not is an open question, I guess, but I don't consider immigration in America a problem. The problem, I think, today in America is there are not enough immigrants. In the United States, there's a massive shortage of good people coming into the country. So I don't consider immigration per se a threat. Again, I consider us the threat. It's the way we deal with the immigrants. So, yes, it is a problem when Mexicans come to America. And when they come to America to have a better life. They come to America because America's freer. They come to America because there's something about the American spirit that they want to adopt. And their kids go to school. And at the school, the professors tell them, no, there's nothing special about America. America is actually awful. America is a horrible place. Mexico, California really belonged to Mexico. You should be out in the streets advocating for returning California to Mexico. Really? They left Mexico to come to California for a reason, because it's not Mexico. But they're taught by Americans, by us, that we are nothing. We are beneath nothing. Multiculturalism is not about the elevation of other cultures to our level. It's about the rejection of Western civilization as a good culture. Not only a good culture, the best culture in human history. No other culture of human beings flourished, lived longer, lived wealthier, lived happier, created more products, more art, more material wealth, more wealth of all sorts than in Western civilization. And yet we denounce it, particularly at our universities, particularly, at least my experience, in America. So I don't blame the immigrant kid who's coming in, particularly the second generation, of condemning the United States. I blame his professors who are teaching this and who are indoctrinating a whole generation in the inferiority of Western civilization. And I think to some extent, and Douglas mentions this in his book, to some extent the problem is, even with these Muslim immigrants, it's not so much that they are the problem. It's that when they come here, we don't expect them to live up to our standards. So why aren't we prosecuting them fully for female genital mutilation? Why aren't we expecting them to live up to our standards just in a most basic level of just following the law? And I think that's a big part of the problem is if we appear weak and if we don't expect them to live up to us, then yeah, the worst elements within them or if not the worst element, the culture that they brought with them will sustain itself. If they're told, your culture is just as good as us, as ours, then yeah, well, that's a problem. No, your culture is barbaric. Your culture is primitive. Your culture should die. You came here, adopt a better product, a better culture. If they were told that, then I don't believe immigration would be a problem. But they're not. So immigration's a massive problem, particularly because of this large immigration of Muslims. Now, I've got some stuff I'd say about mass immigration, which I think is different than regular immigration, about importing people and paying them to come, which I think Europe has done through its welfare state. There's a lot about the fact that we're kind of at war with certain elements within the Islamic world, but we don't identify. So there's a lot to say about that topic, but I don't think that what's killing Western civilization are immigrants, certainly not in America. What's killing America is Americans, the choices and decisions Americans have made, the intellectuals primarily in America have made. And to blame it on the other, I think, is a mistake.
Okay.
First of all, I agree that it can be a mistake. Yeah. In fact, it always is a mistake unless there's anything to it, obviously. And I think people have to be aware of that. And I think broadly speaking, at any rate in Europe, we are aware of that. We have, if anything, rather too strong antibodies to any discussion in this area.
I agree.
The expectation, the ability to claim fascism or xenophobia, for instance, is too easily used. Yeah. For instance, let me give an example. Why have we fallen? I owe this observation to my friend Eric Weinstein, who mentioned this to me on stage recently in Australia. Why have we fallen for this idea that if you are a restrictionist on immigration, you are also a xenophobe? I'm a restrictionist on immigration, and I'm a xenophile, if anything. I don't hate people from other places. I'm very interested in other places. I don't just want to sit in Kent for the rest of my life. I happen to love Kent, by the way. No, but, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't only want to speak to people from the same county or anything. But why do we have nothing in our political language to concede that you can be a restrictionist and a xenophile? We don't. It's, if you want to restrict immigration, it's because you hate people of different coloured skins. You must hate other cultures. You must only want to eat a certain type of food for the rest of your life and only speak to people from the same village or whatever. It's unbelievably crass that at this point we're still at that level of debate on all of this, and we are. You mentioned this this issue, by the way, of... You said something which made my ears perk up. You said this thing of that America needs good people. I don't disagree. I think it's just too easy a point to make without making the opposite point, which is, okay, in that case, who do you think are bad people? Now, this is the real problem that we have with all discussion on immigration. Everybody says that everybody is just great, and nobody wants to say what's bad. And there's a reason for that built into the whole thing, certainly in Europe. I don't want to talk about the case of America for now, but in the case of Europe, it's for one particular reason. You say, why didn't we do a better job in persuading people to become part of this amazing thing that we've had? The obvious reason is because we didn't expect this to happen. We never planned for this. We never planned for it. When post-war migration started, it did not start with the expectation that we would get to where we are now. It just started. And as Angela Merkel said in the Potsdam speech in 2010, she said about the Gastarbeiter in Germany and across Europe, she said, after they came, we thought they would go home. Now that's an amazing, amazing admission to make from the German Chancellor. We didn't think they would stay. Now, if you invite in millions of people into your country, from, in their case, mainly from Turkey, it's likely that if you invite in millions of Turkish men, millions of Turkish men may well want to meet Turkish women, or at least women. And when men meet women, some things happen, I'm told. And if that happens, it's likely that they're going to have to enter the school system. Oh, of course. It's not as if you can pretend, keep them out. And you're going to enter the health care, and so on and so forth. And then before you know it, you change your idea. You say, well, we'd like you to come and do these jobs, and oh, you're staying. Okay, fine. We need to take an attitude towards that. And you invent various attitudes towards it. And for a time, we said, sure, you just do whatever you want, pretty much. And then we said, actually, you should become like us. So I also do not blame an individual immigrant for that. If I were an immigrant who had come to Britain in the 1950s and had gone through to now, I would be bloody confused about what was expected of me. Absolutely confused. And that is not their fault, it's ours. I absolutely agree. But that's because, as I say, there was no overarching theory about this whole thing. It started, it kept going, and we had to keep adapting where we were as a response to that. And that's why we're in this strange position now where, as I say, you cannot, for instance, argue anything that is restrictionist without these whole loads of other things coming in. The final point on that, which is, I mean, you can't get, even now, if I say to a politician, and I do it occasionally because I like to see them sometimes suffer.
Yes.
If you say to a politician live on a stage, if either of you were a serving politician from either of the main parties, and I said to you, who do we not want more of in Britain? Now, I know what happens, because I've seen it. Their eyes go like saucers. They see their political demise happen in the next few seconds. Headlines, excommunication from the party, and so on. The most I managed once with a smart young Labour politician, I managed to get her to say that she thought we shouldn't have more criminals. And I said, well, what about some poor boy from Tunisia, say, who stole something from the local market and went to prison for that? But what, he shouldn't come? Well, we don't want more war criminals.
War criminals.
So there are about four guys in The Hague who are going to be there for life and are not applying to come to live in London. Okay, so if that's the best we can do, we're in trouble. But for the time being, it is the best we can do. And I don't say... I said that'd be a final point. My final point on that point is that this is the major problem on immigration we're all in. We all want to talk the language of inclusion, and rightly so, because we need to include people who are here. But the language of inclusion necessitates a language of exclusion. Not just what you do want to include, but what you exclude. And the point you make, I mean... It's now become, if I may say so, it's become something of a cliche, the FGM debate, but let's stick with it for a second. Which is, you know, London Evening Standard a couple of years ago starts a campaign, stop FGM in our capital. We've got prominent politicians from all parties coming out against FGM. What a terrific paper the London Evening Standard is to be doing this, and so on and so forth. Still, of course, as we all know, not one prosecution for that crime here. But, you know, the total political unanimity. You can now be opposed to it, like the London Evening Standard. It's not the wacky thing it was 15 years ago to oppose the mutilation of young girls' genitals. And still nothing happens.
Yeah.
And just as a thought experiment, what should be easier to oppose than that? Don't hack away like that and ruin the lives of young girls. Please. Oh, after 30 years, still nothing happens, but at least we can run front pages about it.
Can I say...
Okay, because I'm now... It's my fault, but I do want to bring the audience in. But I'm going to be bringing... I'll take clumps of four or five people. I think there's an awful lot that we might want to respond to, challenge, ask questions about. So I'll start here. I don't know if there is a microphone from the organisers. But anyway, if I start with you, please.
Douglas was saying we never get on to let's talk it up. You know, let's remind ourselves why this is good. And so far, all I've heard this evening, and I've enjoyed myself immensely, but I'm putting you to it, all I've heard this evening is let's have a few more FGM prosecutions. Can you please do better than that?
Quite so.
Okay, thank you. Yes, okay, right. How am I going to do this? All right, well, obviously that person there, because they're close. No, there. No, just right close. I was trying to stop you running. I will make you. Get you? Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to have a go at answering this question about the search for meaning. I think maybe one of the problems is that people in a search for meaning have turned inward. Of course, Western civilization was supposed to be about the individual, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you've got to become this... self-obsessed, how do you feel, are you offended, all this kind of thing. And I wonder that there's a paradox that maybe to understand your place in the world, you don't look inward, you look outward. That might be at the world around you, it might be at history, and also literature. And I think the arts and literature in education have had a real going over, and I think that's a shame. And I think maybe expecting young people to read more and read more from the canon and get their ideas from that might be a way forward.
I don't know who you are, sir, but I agree with everything that you said, so that was very good. Let me take those two people there. Then I'm going to start the next time. We'll start down here and we'll kind of work back. Right, so this, sorry, I was trying to make... There's two at the back still, so I just deal with those two. Then I'll come back to you, and if you can just briefly pick things up. Yeah.
Thank you. My question goes to all three panellists. Everyone agreed on the fact that the West is sort of devoid of a greater meaning at the moment. Douglas touched on it briefly in a very individualistic way, in that meaning should be derived from those around you being a better neighbour. But I'm wondering if all three could give an opinion on a meaning outside the individual, a pan-Western meaning, what should be our motive, what should be our purpose as a collective civilisation. Thank you. And okay. I love the book, by the way, Douglas. Thanks.
Thank you. And the person behind as well, who had their hand up. Yeah.
Hi. Next Friday is the fourth anniversary of the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong. And they are people who look to Western values such as liberty and human rights, but nobody seems to really stand up for them, especially the UK, because actually these people chose to leave communism to be under British protection. Why is nobody standing up for these people who look for an alternative in the West?
Okay, thank you. Douglas, just pick up anything. Don't pick up all of it, but if you just pick up a couple of points there.
I'm so pleased you mentioned that one. I was in Hong Kong as the protests were sort of dwindling, really, maybe a couple of years ago. It was a very sad sight. I came back and said to everyone in Europe when I was back, you know, why has there been so little support for the protesters in Hong Kong? And you see, here, everyone says, but it's China, what are you going to do? Everyone I know in France says, but it's China, what are you going to do? Now, the one country in the world that doesn't say that is America, but nobody likes the surgeon. So this is a big problem. I happen to think that, I agree with you, it's something that we should be more forthright about, but then I was saying this recently to an audience in Australia, because Australia is really going through a change of scene about its attitudes now towards China. You just see them on the cusp of the turn. I said to them, look, okay, you're big, this audience is a nice Melbourne audience or something. Okay, you're all very big on like civil rights in... You really like the Dalai Lama. Okay, let's say that liking the Dalai Lama and wanting more human rights in China and better support of the protesters in Hong Kong means that your household GDP goes down by 10%. How do you like the Dalai Lama now? Okay, turns out the Dalai Lama can be ditched for 10%. 15%, you're going to ditch the protesters in Hong Kong, and so on. I don't say this because I want to make them cynics. I say it in order for them not to be posing about this. Like, recognize the cost of your morality and either be willing to pay that price or don't pretend. Don't show up, because that's my primary feeling about the protesters in Hong Kong. They wanted us, quite rightly, to be on their side when they discovered that our price was very, very cheap. As for the other questions, when a question starts with Immanuel Kant, you really know you've got a good audience. But let me skip that one and leave it to Yaron. I wanted to pick up, I suppose, on just the point the gentleman made about meaning. You're right, I did make a somewhat interior point about that. But let me try it in an exterior way. So I'm not religious myself, although I very much understand the religious impulse. I probably am religious, I'm just a non-believer. I don't think that you can get a better set of sources of meaning than what is in every bookshop and library in this city, in many of the art galleries in this city, in all of them in Europe, and much more. Now, this makes me sound purely like an aesthete, but aesthetics isn't a bad place to start. What does the antique torso of Apollo say to Rilke? What is it in German? Du musst dein Leben ändern. You must change your life. Now, art very often poses that point to us. It asks us, it tells us, you should change your life. You must change your life. Now, it does not give the dogmatic answers that religion by necessity has to give. but it's not nothing. And the people who present this as just something you could choose, on the other hand, you might choose not to, really make a mistake. What we have here is not nothing. The discoveries of Europe, the art of Europe, the music of Europe, the literature of Europe, the painting of Europe, the sculpture of Europe. Has anyone done more than this? And everyone worries about this because they think you're going to say, oh, and therefore it's for us. It's going to be like, you know, the thing that happens when it's like you get fearful at the end of Die Meistersinger von Nuremberg when you think, ah, no, it's a bit coming up about, ah, can we just skip that bit about it going to be German art for German people? That's what people fear. But my point is the opposite. My point is this can be for everybody. So why don't we say to people, reach out and take it, it can be yours. What else are you going to do with your life than live in that inheritance and play a part in it? And even if you don't see a part that you can play in it, at least help it to keep going. Don't make your generation the final chapter of that, after which, what?
Okay, I think actually that last point is very useful because it's one of the things I wonder whether the audience recognise, which is the universalizing character of Western civilization mm-hmm. is being lost in the accusation that if you even mention Western civilization, it means that you're a white supremacist who only likes the West yeah. and has never yes. understood anything yeah. about anywhere else. Whereas actually, historically, Western civilization was just the phrase that was used for the universal, the best that we'd become, and everybody wanted it. And nobody ever kind of wandered around thinking, that means I've sold out my Eastern heritage. Or, I mean, that just didn't come into it, did Absolutely. It? So it's kind of got lost in this.
And where the East has succeeded, it's to a large extent because they've adopted elements of Western civilization. I mean, for whatever historical reason, the West came up with the ideas that work for human flourishing. They work, the ideas of liberty, the ideas of freedom. The fact that demonstrators are demonstrating for democracy in Hong Kong is because they're Western. These are Western ideas that they've adopted. Good for them. And I consider Western civilization a universal civilization, not a civilization of a particular geography. I agree with everything Douglas just said about art. If you're looking to save Western civilization, one of the things we need to really resurrect and return to is the great aesthetic achievement of Western civilization. And again, this is the issue of expectation. When immigrants come here, we should be telling them, go listen to Beethoven, go to the museums, look, these values are not because we're white-skinned. It has not. I'm Jewish. I love Beethoven and Wagner because the values they represent are universal. It has nothing to do with the fact that they're German. I mean, it has something to do. But the essential, what they're really conveying, is a universal value and universal meaning. And this era, the last 200, 250 years, has produced, particularly in its first 150 years, has produced amazing universal masterpieces that should speak to all of us, no matter the color of our skin, no matter our background, no matter where we come from. And yes, that's where we can find meaning in our own lives. Because I think at the end of the day, meaning is about the choices you make, the kind of person you want to become, the values you create for yourself. Somebody asked about a meaning outside of us, and part of the danger there is that when we talk about that, we talk about a meaning outside of us, we talk about some collective meaning, you know, the greatness of fill in the blank. And I think there's many, many dangers there. What I'd like in terms of is objectively good values that are good for us: liberty, freedom, fighting for those things. That gives one meaning. Capitalism. I know it's a dirty word, particularly sitting next to a Marxist, or former Marxist. But capitalism is the kind of thing that is worth fighting for. Look at how many people are not poor anymore in the world because of capitalism. There's a universal value and meaning outside of you, but important to you. It always returns to the value to you as an individual and viewing other people as individuals. Now I'm going to take a shot at these really quick.
One. Gary Morin.
I'm going to do two. I'm going to do the answer, replacing Christianity's enlightenment values. You don't need religion in order to inspire passion and inspire and discover truth and fight for truth. Truth is, religion actually, I think, diverts us away from the search for real truth. So enlightenment values. And then I just have to say something quickly about Kant. If you read in the introduction to Critique of Pure Reason, Kant says that the purpose of what he's doing is to save Christianity, or save religion, save faith from the Enlightenment. Kant is the first anti-Enlightenment philosopher. He is the rejection of the Enlightenment and the beginning of a path towards something anti-Enlightenment, anti-everything that we believe in, the anti-scientific revolution.
I'm so tempted to join in on the Kant, but I won't. Right, okay, so I've got the microphone is there, sir. Yes?
My question is to Douglas. Firstly, I'm an Australian and I fully agree with your concerns about the Chinese government interference in Australian government. I'm very concerned about that. So I'm glad to hear that you've raised it on the other side of the world. My question is, how do we get the political class to talk about difficult issues? You've touched upon it tonight. You've talked about it in previous debates. How do we get the political class, particularly in this country, to talk about other immigration or problems within certain areas of the Islamic community? Coming from Australia, I noticed that we're a little bit more open and honest, sometimes too much, on certain issues. If you're someone like Sarah Champion, you can pay a severe price for being outspoken on what one would consider a particularly serious issue, that being rape gangs. I can't think of a more, to paraphrase Douglas, I can't think of a more serious concern to raise further to the discussion on FGM. So how do we get the political class to acknowledge these issues and talk about them without fear of losing their political careers and exposure and degradation to their personal lives?
Okay, thank you. So I promise this gentleman here, just because he's had his hand up from the very start. This gentleman here, please. Pass it along and he can take it. Yeah, thank you. And then I'll take a little gaggle, yeah? And then there's some more, yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for a really stimulating discussion. So on the search for meaning, you all spoke about the, you do have people who demand, you know, a certain moral relativism between really awful ideas that we've talked about and what we've managed to create and instill in the West. And my question really is to any of you is, what's the motive behind this? It's easy to kind of say, and I do it myself sometimes, oh, it's just they're evil, or they're just, they want to see the West fail. Is it guilt? Is it that they're uninformed? Is it that they're misinformed? I wanted to get your take on that. And because, you could argue fairly, the West has done, and when we're individuals, so we don't want to just attribute blame to everyone because of past issues, but the West has made mistakes in the past. The US, the UK, slavery, for example. But the difference in the West is that we ended slavery, and the rest of the world didn't. Most slavery takes place in sub-Saharan Africa, the Far East, South America. So could you kind of give the devil its due, in a way? I know it might be difficult. And in a way, kind of steelman the postmodern argument in terms of, why they have the perspectives that they have on the West, and why, like you say, Aaron, the Mexican kid goes to the US and he gets lectured about how amazing Mexico is. Could you steelman that argument and give us an insight into that? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Little gaggle of people here now. I'm going to take you all, right? And you're going to be quick.
And she could.
Hi, a quick one for Douglas. You mentioned very early on about how the West was not, or Western civilization was not able to regenerate or to regenerate the enthusiasm or the culture of Western civilization. We weren't able to do it. We needed something from outside. I didn't get that point too well. And putting my manager hat on, so what do we do about it? What are the next steps?
Okay, thank you. And
Hello. Hi, so to Yaron mainly, and it was answering the question about Christianity. I don't really think it's been... I don't think it's been answered well enough. I actually think one of the cause of all of this discussion is atheism. I think that atheism, and I'm not religious, but I just look around and I think religious people defend their civilizations, atheists do not. And I think it's That's my question.
Fascinating. So the lady behind you, then I'm coming to that row, then I'm coming back, and then I'll deal with the rest of you after, and then we've got to go home. Right, anyway, yes, okay, right.
Mr. Murray's book lays out a very stark numerical comparison between immigration in history and immigration in the past 10 years, and gives a very reasonable, common sense argument for its unsustainability. And I wonder, however correct individualism might be epistemically or ethically, how practicable is it in addressing these material concerns that we face today? And dare I say it, I have to wonder if adherence to one's tribe, one's nation, however not philosophically backed, might serve us better in addressing this demographic crisis.
Okay, well, I think that you, I don't agree with you, but I think that you raise something which a lot of people are thinking at the moment, and I think that's true. As we know that identity politics is expressing itself in a variety of ways, and I know that that's an important thing that you've raised there. Okay, so, yes, yes, you know what you're doing. Yes, carry on. Yeah. Well, yeah.
If the panel is going to deal with the question of Christianity, I would like to ask a counter question. It seems to me that one of the fundamental tenets of Christianity is altruism, in other words, sacrificing yourself for other people, which does seem to be a cause, an excuse for so much collectivism.
And that young lady there, then I'll come back. Then I'll come back. I know you can't deal with it, but it's nice to get a sense of what the audience are thinking about. But anyway, there you go.
Just to go forward on the idea of the search for meaning, I think you raised a really good point, Douglas, about not often showing pride in our country, in our school system as well, but that it can quite often maybe go further than that in terms of actually being able to give them the tools to search for meaning. Sometimes, even if you go back to religion, you can look at it and say, well, if you're not religious and suddenly you don't believe in an afterlife, there's this huge void, and that can be a very scary thing to actually think about. Well, that can, as we look further into things, we can often find those voids. But actually, in our school system, are we giving them the tools to be able to handle that, to have the ability to see other things, to be immersed in other experiences, to have the pride and to actually have the tools to be able to deal with it and to find it for themselves? Or are we seeing a generation coming forward going, I want to make a difference, but when you challenge them on it, they don't know what difference they want to make?
Yeah, very interesting. Just pick something up. I'll start with you. I'm coming back. I'll start with you. Pick up a few afterwards, yeah? Right. Anything you want to pick up? Very quick, Douglas, please.
It's fantastic set of questions. I'll be very brief. How can the political class address this, gentlemen, that? Look, I think one thing in particular, which is there has to be a price for not addressing it. At the moment, there is only a price for addressing difficult questions. There is no reward for addressing them. Sarah Champion, who I'm so pleased you mentioned, the Labour MP, who, as you say, I mean, this monstrosity happened in her constituency. Why should she not say it? And so I think that the people who don't say it, there should be some means of effectively punishing them as politicians. Now, I have often said that I think that will happen at some point. I saw it come very close after the massacre in Paris in November 2015, when I thought that both Angela Merkel and Jean-Claude Juncker, when they went quiet. They went quiet because they knew that if it turned out the people who'd massacred 130 people in one night had come through the migrant routes that they had encouraged, then there was going to be hell to pay in Europe. Now, I happen to think that will happen at some point. I think that is bound to happen at some point, and there will be a political price to pay. The problem is that I don't see it. I see the further away it is, the more it's postponed, the more unpleasant it's going to be, is my prognosis. The gentleman asked us to steel man the argument of the postmodernists. Broadly speaking, I think the postmodernists, you could put them into two groups, ones who genuinely are postmodernists and ones who are happy to ride on postmodernism till it gets them to their destination, which is, for instance, communism or anarchy, all sorts of things. But I mean, broadly speaking, they're two different groups, and as always, the people who are being ridden don't know they're being ridden. But the postmodernists, the real ones, of which there are some, Broadly speaking, I think that it slightly ties in, if I may say so, with the regeneration point, which the gentleman there made. It's sort of part of the same thing. Something like this. Everything that we've done ourselves, everything that comes from our own history and tradition, is in some way fettered. Like, philosophy is very dangerous ground because we still haven't worked out what happened in the 20th century, and it's still all got crime scene tape around it. And that is not a bad reason to be fearful of something. You know, 100 million people dead from communism, however many tens of millions dead from Nazism, you know, it's worth being worried. And that's why people, even philosophers who get mentioned, we get back to it. This is this endless thing of going back to these sources and trying to find out where the whole thing went wrong. And that means it's dangerous. It means that philosophy is dangerous. Words are dangerous. Ideas are dangerous. So why don't we just, like, pull the whole thing apart, make it undangerous, make it just meaningless? Because that way nobody can do anything dangerous again. And there's something like that going on. The endless thing that they're doing, even within groups, pulling groups apart, seems to me to be part of the thing. Let nobody organize along any kind of communal grounds, or communal lines, something like that. The regeneration point I wanted to make was that, yes, as I said, that we seem not to be able to think we've got it ourselves, that we have to go elsewhere to get it, seems to me. And this comes back, as I say, to this thing, that the art is dangerous because it's been misused. Sure. Sure it has. Is that a reason not to be involved? Religion has gone wrong, therefore we have nothing to do with religion. Sure, religion's gone wrong. Does that mean you have nothing to do with religion? I think this is one of our self-imposed things, which is a virtue, is that we remember. I was looking the other day at that Steven Pinker book from only about, 14 years ago, The Blank Slate. It has a wonderful chart of the proportions of males who are killed in bloody, violent conflict in the West and in a whole set of places around the world that most people in the West have never heard of. And the bit on the graph of men killed in violent warfare in the West is like this. And all of these things that people have not heard of is like this on the chart. It's like, again, compared to what? What are you doing when you make these claims about it? Is it just that we happen to be the people who remember things, and therefore we remember all of this stuff, including the terrible stuff? Is it that other people are better at forgetting? Sometimes, yes. The Turkish government, for instance, is encouraging people to forget. Just very quickly, I do need to pick up on the lady's point about education.
Very, very tiny. Yeah.
You can't give us millions of questions.
Yeah. No, but you don't.
But I will be
brief. We will have to be evicted from the room.
I will be brief. Look, I think that the main thing about this, the education of the tool, is something. Is this. There seems to me to be a broad attempt to educate children to be world citizens. And world citizens, can, when they're brought up as such, can very rarely point to any other country accurately on a map. Because to be a citizen of the world, you don't have to actually visit the world. Now, my own view is that in education, the best thing you can do for any child is to bring them up very thoroughly within a tradition, with a canon, with reference points that they can find throughout their lives. And then, having learned that, to encourage them to go out into the world and discover it. But if you encourage them to go from that bit out, it's all mush. It's all mush unless you have that place to start from. There's this beautiful thing that Woody Allen, I think we can still quote Woody Allen, I'm not sure. I haven't checked the news today, but Woody Allen once said in an interview that he felt that having not gone to university, he had missed out on what he sort of did this, the bridge. He could do bits of it, he just felt he couldn't do. Now, you don't have to go to university to do that, you can self-teach for this. But to know how you get from there to there means you can then go out and do it endlessly. To only get little bits that are disjointed, the whole world is going to be chaos to you.
Okay, thank you. Right, Yaron. No, Yaron, I was just going to say... I was just going to explain. We're not going to have time for very many people. There's two people there. I'm going to take three people over here after Yaron's talked, and I'm very sorry because we've run out of time. And then you'll have to talk to them individually as they sign books. Yaron.
So let me say, I mean, it saddens me that so many people, particularly the secular people in the audience, are so pining for religion. And I find it really interesting because religion has this monopoly, it seems, on meaning, on the sacred, on, you know, maybe a certain passion for ideas. And I think that is unbelievably sad and untrue. I think the problem is that we haven't really thoroughly cleansed ourselves of all the damage religion can do. You know, it served its purpose at a time, but does not anymore. I think we still hold on to Christian morality, which I think, for example, the gentleman mentioned, I think is a dangerous morality at the end of the day. It is a morality that leads us towards the collectivism and the destructive tendencies that, yes, atheists did, but in the name of the same morality that's been taught for 2,000 years under communism, under fascism, and under other forms of collectivism. It leads into that. I mean, the Enlightenment at the end of the day is an incomplete project. It was not fully completed. And one of the things the Enlightenment thinkers refused to do, and I include from Locke on through certainly Adam Smith, is they refused to challenge some of the premises of religion, in particular its morality. They challenged it in metaphysics, they challenged it in epistemology, but they refused to challenge it in ethics. And I think until we're ready to do so, until we can find meaning, purpose, in our own lives as individuals and really ground our political individualism in a moral individualism, then I think we're going to be lost. And I think it's hard to fight for something unless you clearly understand it and have fully embraced it. But think about, you know, think about what we have today. We keep going, somebody said we're all negative. No, I mean, I keep saying, and I think Douglas keeps saying, look how wonderful life is in the West, in spite of the immigrants, in spite of all the problems, in spite of all the things. I mean, we live longer. We have access. I mean, one of the things I marvel at, I can sit on my sofa at home and control using my iPhone to control my amazing stereo system. I have access to every piece of music ever written, pretty much. Yeah. You know, to the greatest, not just the greatest music, but every particular interpretation of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony I can listen to. And in my own time, whenever I feel like it, in my own... I mean, it's unthinkable the kind of access we have to this, to the great aesthetics, but generally to the great products of human achievement. So let's embrace that. That's worth fighting for. That's worth being passionate about. That's worth standing on the barricades and rejecting barbarism for my ability to do that, to live the kind of life that is accessible to each one of us, the product of individualism, the product of capitalism, the product of liberty. We should be passionate about fighting for it. And where we're lacking, and I think we're lacking in a proper moral code, that's where we need to be investing in investigating and re-embracing philosophy to investigate. To morality should be a science of how, of discovering the values and virtues that make our life successful as human beings, make our lives the best life that it can be as human beings. And if we embrace that, what's more sacred than your own life? And what's more, you know, use any of the religious terms and just apply it into the secular, and you get that same passion and that same commitment that I think. I'll
be back in a minute.
Just this one. Look, I'm not going to get into the whole history of religion, right? But you certainly don't want to go back to an era in which Catholics were killing Protestants. I mean, they make the Muslims seem a little meek if you go back to the 30-year war, the 100-year war. I mean, we don't want to go back to an era where we took religion seriously, right? We can, from afar, secularists look at religion and say, oh, they have some nice things over there. But we don't want to really embrace it as a serious thing, because when we did, we slaughtered one another. It was not a happy period of European history when Europe took its religion seriously. So let's embrace the values, the secular values that are out there, that are pro-human, that are pro-flourishing.
All right, fantastic. Don't ask any questions. I'll take a couple of points, and then you two can have a minute each at the end to give us your final thought. So don't ask them questions, because then they'll say they've got need to answer them, and we'll be here all night. Right.
I just thought,
the conversation. Yeah.
I just thought maybe it might be advantageous to try and look for and promote secularism in Islam. You know, whether in the Renaissance, look for what traditions they have which are of value. Their music or Persian poetry or and so on, their architecture, and try and bring them into Europe, bring them into the European story, as opposed to say, listen to Beethoven. Yeah. I'm just joking, of course.
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you. And the lady behind.
Well, this is a question, but are you saying that Western civilization is in decline or is it a risk of being in decline or destruction? And if it is in decline, then what is worse now? What is worse about life now?
There's no chance I can answer that. Bloody hell. That's the whole point tonight. Right, okay, yes, sir. Yeah, I'm joking, sorry.
Just my points on supranational governmental structures, Yugoslavia, Soviet Union, EU. They're not the cause, but they're an accelerant on the problem. So the supranational structure and the sort of bureaucratic, authoritarian, soulless cultures that they have, such as multiculturalism that's empty, invite all the world in to be in this glorious new citizen. That, I think, is part of the problem as well. That mindset, the Macron-Merkel version of it, as opposed to what now looks to be the Orbán-Salvini alternative.
Okay, thank you. So there's that gentleman there, and then you.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest problems we face is in education, specifically the fact that we're not honestly conversant with history in an honest way, because I believe many of the things both of you or everyone on the panel argues against is easily dispellable by an honest reflection on history. Why, for instance, was it that I spent countless years learning about Henry VIII and his six wives and about the crimes of Hitler as if I'd have forgotten after a year or the next year or the next year? Why is it that we never learn about the evils of socialism in history? I mean, I'm not expecting you to answer this. I'm just asking everyone to sort of reflect. Why is it in our education system that certain things are sort of left unaddressed completely?
Rhetorical question, as I say. Yes, and the gentleman behind. You. Block, that's it. Sorry. And then you, yeah.
Okay, thank you. All over the West, in every election which I observe, the electorate are moving further and further to the right. They're voting for anti-Islamic parties. As we've discussed, there is a huge void. What fills that void is open to discussion. I think Douglas mentioned the fact that the longer this goes on, the more dangerous, that it wasn't your word, but the more dangerous the response might be. My question to you specifically, I think you're on, is what is the response going to be when the anti-Islamic parties actually get into power? Because if the current trends continue, especially in Europe, we are 5 to 15 years away from an entire continent being controlled by parties who want to whatever extent, deal with the Islamic problem. And they propose dealing with that in different ways. And how do you think they're going to deal with that? Are they going to use reason? Are they going to use force?
Okay, yes.
Is technology killing capitalism? So we have a sense where Amazon is becoming a huge organization, and we can't let it become apolitical. So even if it's slightly political, it has huge impacts on the day-to-day lives of everyone. So I think, in the sense that the technology is actually killing freedom and liberty.
Okay, interesting. Thank you. And then, I'm sorry, final point for the floor. This gentleman, yeah. I'm sorry, everyone.
My question is for Iran. Iran, I like to think that perfection is the enemy of the good. And you said earlier that we should encourage Beethoven to others, the outsiders. But I like to think, and I know objectivism has an opinion on hedonism, and I agree with it. But what I do think is if we're on the campus, I think it's valuable to approach the leftists and say, look, if you want to do what you do in your bedroom or at the nightclub, do be aware that there are people who have a very frowning opinion on that, and they want to physically punish you. And I think, as I said, perfection is the enemy of good. So we could say, okay, you know, defend your hedonism, at least for now. Let's gain an inch. Because if I think that's a really good way to sort of get at the emotional side of them. So, and I'd like to know what your thoughts are on that.
Okay, thank you, audience. I really like to thank the both of you before I bring you in for stimulating such a lot of discussion. And I know that I didn't get time to bring everyone in. But I think the fact that people wanted to speak is an indication of the fact that this is a conversation that needs to happen and that people want to join in. And we've had some fantastic answers from the front, but there's a lot more, isn't there? So I think that's why I'd like to thank the organisers, because I think you see that you've stimulated that kind of conversation. I wanted to just pose to you one dilemma, and I can assure you that I was going to get some stick. I have had some stick for sharing this tonight, and people will say, you know, that there is the rise of anti-Islam right-wing parties. Who that gentleman said that this is inevitably a lot of the things we've heard tonight will feed into that. That there is a problem of people thinking that radical Islam and Muslims are interchangeable in the way they view things. We know that that happens. There is a problem potentially. I don't think there's a rise of racism in the way that people describe, but I do recognise something of a kind of white identity emerging, which makes me feel bloody anxious, I can tell you now. I don't like identity politics. White identity politics isn't going to make me even feel better, let me tell you. So I wondered how... I know I'm now asking you a question, but I'm the chair, I'm allowed. Anyway, right, OK. Because we need to all go and buy books and sign them and so on, but just give us your final thoughts.
First of all, I can slightly try to tie up those questions. The partisan Europe point, I spend a certain amount of my time still going to... Well, I think by the end of this year, I've once again been to every country in the EU. I'm usually in a different country every week, so I get it somewhat chaotic, but fairly clear insight into what's happening. My own view has been for a long time that it's all moving some way out to my side, which is not happy news for everyone. But this is what happens when you postpone things you should have dealt with a long time ago. And at some point, the account is called in. And I just hope that it's done in a decent way. I think there are some people who will do it in a decent way, and I think there are some who will do it in the most indecent way imaginable. But, by the way, among other things, nobody here cares to delineate which is all part of the problem, because everyone's still a racist, everyone's still a fascist. And the fastest way to create those things is to keep using that term about everybody, including the majority of the public in every country. Very quickly, somebody mentioned religion again. I just suppose I'd mention this. I mean, religion is very strong. It's the strongest drink in the cabinet. And so you have to approach it carefully. You have to be careful not to take too much of it. It doesn't mean you should take none. It doesn't mean you should walk away from the cabinet or indeed lock it. Just know that these are very, very dangerous, strong substances. But there's a reason, because they're the only things that claim to be able to go right down to the bottom of the well and bring up the real stuff. Now, I think that one of the conclusions I've started to come to has been that we may be in this phase of discovering that the only thing worse than religion is its absence, and that people are going to have the religious urge whether you or I or any of us like it or not, and that something's going to walk into it. What is identity politics but a kind of religion? What is the social justice warriorism but a kind of religion? All of this stuff is recognizable. The desire to flagellate yourself, the desire to exonerate yourself, the desire to be better than the other person, to judge the other person, to not judge yourself or to judge yourself by some standard but a lesser standard, and so on and so forth. The problem we have in the West is that we are stuck in something that Nietzsche foresaw, which is that we have the remainders of Christianity in terms of guilt, but we have no means for the alleviation of guilt. And this is the deep underlying problem for us. So I just say that religion's going to be in the mix. You're going to have to find a way to live with it always. it ain't going away. But I suppose there's a lot more to say, but I just finally would say one thing, if I may, which is, it seems to me that the thing that we miss, and it hasn't come up tonight, but the thing we keep missing is something Alan Bloom, one of my great heroes, wrote in a book some 30 years ago or so. He said about American students in the 80s, he said that they had a very good idea of what a good body was. They had no idea anymore what a good soul was. And it seems to me that, again, like mentioning Beethoven, it's a sort of embarrassing thing to mention, but we're going to have to mention it anyway. The creation, the education, the upbringing of good souls is of primary importance.
Thank you very much, Dave. Can we give that a warm?
So, I agree with regard to religion, its attractiveness, and I agree with that many of these secular beliefs are indeed religious beliefs. I would even argue that communism is ultimately a religion. It is that which is based on faith and not reason. It is that which sacrifices the individual to the community, to the group, to the tribe, to the country, to whatever. That is the enemy. And if that is religion, then religion, whether it's identity politics or whether it's communism or whether it's Christianity, is the enemy. Anything that's anti-reason, in my book, is the enemy. We need to replace religion. We need to help people substitute that desire for meaning that they get from all these types of religions with something better, with something based on reason. And I think the creating of character, creating of a human soul, as Douglas just mentioned, is the way to do that. What we should be seeking as a Western civilization. But what are those universal values? What are the values that truly lead to individual success, to individual flourishing? And we need to help people discover those values, teach them those values, and then say, in this sense, maybe I'm more of a globalist because I'd like to see the canon be the best rather than the canon that happens to be from where I was born geographically. I'd like to find the best canon and teach the best canon so we can shape the best souls and we can shape the best characters. We're not really shaping them, they're shaping themselves, but we can expose people to the opportunity to shape the best souls possible, to achieve the best meaning for their own life possible. And I think we find that not in religion, but we'll find it in that dangerous of fields, that field of philosophy. So I would encourage people to delve deeper into philosophy, to look for the answers in philosophy rather than in faith, rather than in emotion, in reason, in fact, in reality. So, you know, there's so much more. I mean, one of the beauties of this is the extent to which, you know, there's so many things we haven't talked about, right? The extent to which the welfare state is partially responsible for the mess we're in today, and including the immigration mess. Without the welfare state, we wouldn't maybe be in such a mess with the immigration. We haven't talked about what I view as the dramatic decline in the aesthetic quality of the art that we're producing over the last 100 years, and maybe that as a sign of the decline of Western civilization more than anything else I can imagine. The lack of universality in the aesthetics product that is being produced today. And then somebody mentioned history. You know, you talk about we don't teach kids about the evils of socialism. And I'll end with this. Well, we really don't teach kids. And nobody knows, no matter what educational system is about the beauty of capitalism. You know, we teach the 19th century from the perspective of Dickens. But Dickens tells a tiny little sliver what the 19th century was. The 19th century was about people going from $2 a day to wealth. It's about going from life expectancy of 39 to over 60. It's about the creation of the modern world. It's about the art. And it's not an accident that the art is created during the 19th century. Beethoven is the first, the reason maybe Beethoven keeps coming to my mind, Beethoven is the first composer to make money off of his composition without being dependent on some aristocrat writing him checks, but actually doing public concerts and selling tickets. That's capitalism. the beauty of capitalism, the beauty of the Industrial Revolution, the beauty of the 19th century, the most important century in human history in terms of progress. That is what we don't teach. Forget the negatives. We don't teach the positives. We don't teach what is really sustaining human life. So there's no, so to me, it's not surprising that people don't know meaning, that they're infatuated with socialism, they're infatuated with communism now, or with white supremacy or whatever, because they don't know what's positive. They don't know what's led to the greatest civilization in human history, which is what we're living through. In spite of its decline, it's still the greatest time to be alive if you're a human being in terms of what you can do with your own life, particularly if you take it on a global scale. So let's teach the positive. Let's focus on the positive. Let's focus on the beauty.
Thank you.
Should I do that now and then you want to do something?
No, Okay, we're about to go. I mean, I was going to just thank, first of all, to thank Razzie and Annie for organising tonight and putting in the work behind the scenes. I was getting really roused up by everything that Yaron said, apart from that kind of hymn to capitalism at the end. But I've decided that as he's just done that, I will just do a bit of capitalist advertising. So he made the point about all of the unanswered questions. Well, luckily, the Battle of Ideas Festival is happening in 3 or 4 weeks' time, which Yaron has spoken at in the past, where we have 400 speakers and 100 panel debates over one weekend, and practically everything he said there has actually got a panel debate discussing it. And we won't all agree at all. I think that tonight has indicated just the richness of the kind of questions people have, and I do apologise to both of you as speakers, because I know you could have answered all those questions in a lot more time. But I think that we got a flavour of what you, as an audience, were thinking about, and we got some very profound and useful... Oh, it's like getting a book reading group. Alan Bloom is also one of my favourite books. There we go, we agree on a lot of things. You know, what a call to arms. And just on that call to arms, because you are all about to go and buy the books that we've just been talking about and get them signed and have one-to-one conversations, Yaron just wants to say something about the work of the Ayn Rand Institute.
Yeah, so just quickly, this event was sponsored by the Ayn Rand Institute. We're based in the United States, but of course today it doesn't matter where you're based. Everything's online. So I encourage you to search out our material on YouTube, on our website, ayn rand.org. Also, for those of you who are students in the audience, we have many programs for students, including a lot of free conferences. We pay you to come, basically. So I encourage you to get engaged. You know, from our perspective, many of the philosophical answers to the questions that were raised today are in her writing. So I encourage you all to go read Atlas Shrugged. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right. Okay. I've just got to say that the Battle of Ideas Festival, we don't pay you to come. What happened there on the capitalist moment there? Right, we don't pay you to come. You have to pay for yourself.
And it's great.
And also, one of the books on sale outside is mine. So you can go and buy it. I'm now going to have a cigarette and then we'll be signing books. Thank you all very much indeed.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.